epistemology. So I don't know if at this point in the day that's a disappointment or a relief, but this work does relate to that still. So if you are interested in how I think this relates to Hinge epistemology, then feel free to ask me about that in the Q&A. So what I am going to talk about today instead is the relationship between epistemic relativism and a kind of feminist epistemology, which is known as standpoint theory. So I'm going to begin by explaining what I mean by both of those views, epistemic relativism and standpoint theory. And I'm briefly going to recount the standard way that the connection between these two views is understood. So the literature at the moment focuses on an aspect of standpoint theory, which is called the epistemic advantage thesis, and on an aspect of relativism, which has been called equality. And I'm going to show that the connection between relativism and standpoint theory actually turns on a different aspect of standpoint theory, which is known as the standpoint thesis, and on an aspect of relativism, which has been called non-neutrality. And I'm going to argue that shifting our attention to these other aspects of these two views reveals that standpoint theory is clearly and unavoidably relativist. But I'm also going to say that this isn't a problem. So standpoint theory can capture everything that it's set out to, even on a relativist understanding of this view. Okay, so first things first, we need a clear definition of relativism. And I'm going to be drawing on work by Martin Kusch, in which, so there's a paper where he does several things, but one of them is that he surveys a number of different accounts of epistemic relativism and identifies some common defining elements of these views. And he discusses a number of elements in that paper, but I'm just going to focus on three of these, which I think are the most important. So the first of these three elements is called dependence. And this is the idea that justification, or more specifically, the justificatory status of beliefs, is relative to an epistemic system or a framework or a practice, something like that. The second element of relativism is plurality. And this says that there are, or there could be, more than one such system or practice. And the final element is something called symmetry. So this says that epistemic systems and practices mustn't be ranked. But Martin identifies a number of different versions of this claim, and I'm going to pull out two which are going to be relevant for the rest of my talk. So one of these is called non-neutrality. Non-neutrality says that there's no neutral way to evaluate different systems. We can't evaluate them without the help of an epistemic system to carry out that evaluation, because like all epistemic judgments, rankings are also system dependent. So with regard to this understanding of symmetry, non-neutrality means that there can be no system-independent ranking of different systems. The other version of symmetry that's going to be relevant for my paper today is equality. And equality says that all standpoints are equally correct. And this is often taken to be an uncontroversial way to cash out this symmetry claim, because if it's not possible to rank epistemic systems with some being better than others, then presumably they must all be equal. That's taken to be kind of a natural thought. But Martin Kirsch has argued that equality seems to conflict with non-neutrality. So it seems to presuppose a neutral system from which that correctness judgment can be made, whilst non-neutrality says that this isn't possible. So for my purposes today, epistemic relativism is a view about epistemic justification on which it's dependent, pluralist, and symmetrical in either the equality sense or in the non-neutrality sense. So that's epistemic relativism explained. Now let's have a look at feminist standpoint theory. So feminist standpoint theory is one of the main branches of feminist epistemology. So I should start by just telling you a little bit about what that is. So feminist epistemology itself is diverse and encompasses lots of different views, but there are three main branches. So there's feminist standpoint theory, there's feminist empiricism, and there's feminist postmodernism. And the differences and similarities between those views get kind of complicated, because people have argued that, for example, some views in standpoint theory take on so much of feminist empiricism that now those views are closer to a lot of feminist empiricist views than they are to other standpoint theory views. So there are three branches, but they kind of intertwine and have grown together a little bit. But one thing which we can take as definitive and unifying of all of these different views is that is something which is called the situated knowledge thesis. And the situated knowledge thesis says that social factors, such as a subject's race and gender, or more generally their status as oppressed or not, can have an effect on what and how we know. So with that idea in place as a backdrop, I can then explain what feminist standpoint theory is. And I'm going to say that it's characterized by two further central theses, which help to clarify and expand on that unifying thesis of all of feminist epistemology. So the first of these two theses is called the standpoint thesis. And this says that justification depends on socially situated perspectives. And we could talk for a long time about what exactly a socially situated perspective is. There are lots of controversies here, and for what it's worth, I think that a good way to understand them is in terms of a set of hinges. But I'm going to put that stuff to the side for today, and to keep things simple, we can just think of them as an epistemic framework, or an epistemic system, which is distinguished by social factors, like things like race and gender. So for the most part today, I'm going to talk about perspectives of those who are socially oppressed and perspectives of those who are socially privileged. The second thesis, which is central to standpoint theory, is the epistemic advantage thesis, which says that the perspectives of those who are socially oppressed can result in better or more justification or more justified beliefs than the perspectives of those who are socially privileged. And again, there are complicated issues here, which I'm going to gloss over. But there is one detail that I am going to just go into to make sure that we don't have any confusion. So I've used the word can in my phrasing of the epistemic advantage thesis. And this is important because it reflects that standpoint theorists don't assume that all and only people who occupy oppressed social locations can attain this epistemic advantage. So some people in oppressed social locations can't and won't achieve this advantage, and some people in privileged social locations can and will. And also all of the people who do attain this advantage, regardless of the background that they're coming from, will have to do so through a difficult process of critical reflection. So it's not something that just happens automatically. And so because of this, the term standpoint is reserved for epistemic systems on which this advantage has actually been achieved. So systems on which it's still just a potential thing that could be achieved are not called standpoints, they're called perspectives. So that's going to be the difference that I'm talking about when it comes to standpoints and perspectives. Standpoints are ones where the epistemic advantage has been achieved. So this is a very rough sketch of standpoint theory, and different authors have cashed out all of the details in different ways. But again, I'm not going to go into loads of detail, and I'm not particularly concerned today with how plausible standpoint theory is as a view in general. What I want to think about is whether and how this view relates to epistemic relativism. And I'm going to flesh out my answer to this question in the rest of the paper. But before getting on to that, I'm just going to say a few things about the standard view on this relationship between relativism and standpoint theory. So the first thing to note is that it's widely reported in the literature that standpoint theory's critics draw a connection between the standpoint thesis and relativism. Now, I've struggled to find defenses of this claim in print. So when this point gets made, when people say, well, lots of people think that the standpoint thesis leads to relativism, it's made as a very general claim. People just talk about critics. They don't cite a particular critic or, you know, point to a particular argument. And I'm not too sure on why this is. My guess is that either this is something that's coming from personal conversations, so maybe when standpoint theorists present their views, this is a question that comes up in Q&A sessions a lot. Or perhaps their worries that are raised by anonymous referees, something like that. But whatever the source of this criticism, there's sort of a general acknowledgement of this in the literature, that there's this suspected connection between the standpoint thesis and relativism. And looking at the elements of relativism as I've introduced them above, I think we can make a good guess at why this is. So the standpoint thesis quite clearly incorporates both dependency, so the idea that justification is system dependent, and pluralism, the idea that there are multiple systems because there are multiple social situations or social locations. So if we have those two elements, all that's needed is the third element, symmetry. And standpoint theory then ticks all of the relativist boxes and is a kind of epistemic relativism. So the second thing to note is that in response to this common objection, standpoint theorists standardly cite the epistemic advantage thesis as a way to respond. So the typical objection is this view, this standpoint thesis leads to relativism, and the typical response is, don't worry, the epistemic advantage thesis will cover this. And again, this is frequently mentioned in print, but the discussion still tends to be quite brief. But I think that the idea is that the epistemic advantage thesis requires that standpoints are ranked. And so in the terms that I've been talking about today, that means that this epistemic advantage thesis isn't compatible with symmetry. So I'm going to begin my exploration of the connection between standpoint theory and relativism with this claim about epistemic advantage and symmetry. I'm going to explain one recent account of epistemic advantage, and I'm going to argue that it is compatible with symmetry, or at least with symmetry which is based on non-neutrality rather than equality. So this account of epistemic advantage is not capable of showing that standpoint theory is not relativism. That's going to be my claim. I'll then move on to discussing relativism and standpoint theory more generally. So I'll argue that non-neutrality follows from the situated knowledge thesis, and so any account of epistemic advantage is going to either be compatible with non-neutral symmetry, or it's going to contradict the first central thesis of standpoint theory. So this means that standpoint theorists have a decision to make. Either they can accept relativism, or they're going to have to radically rethink or abandon a central tenet of their view. And then finally, as I said, I'm going to go on to suggest that the main worries that standpoint theorists have about relativism don't apply to versions which are based on non-neutral symmetry. So moving on to the section on the handout, which is called Medina on epistemic advantage. The epistemic advantage thesis has been cashed out in many different ways by different authors. And today I'm just going to introduce one way that this has been done. So this is an account which is argued for by Jose Medina. Medina has argued for a version of standpoint theory on which epistemic advantage is understood in terms of epistemic character, and specifically in terms of the development of epistemic virtues and vices. On this view, the experiences which people have influence their epistemic character. So since people who are socially oppressed and people who are socially privileged tend in general to have different experiences, they'll tend in general to develop different epistemic characters. And these epistemic characters then influence their ability to respond to something called epistemic friction, which is key to achieving epistemic advantage. So in a moment, I'll go through this process of character development that Medina describes, but first I want to explain what epistemic friction is, so you know why he cares about this, what it's aiming at. So like other kinds of friction that you've probably heard of, epistemic friction is a jarring but a productive force, which occurs when two or more objects come into contact. So if you think about normal friction, think about when you rub your hands together. There's resistance there, and that resistance is productive. It produces heat. In the epistemic case, the objects are different perspectives, and contact between these perspectives can be jarring because subjects often find it challenging to be confronted with beliefs and values different to their own. But it can also be productive, because if we respond to this friction appropriately, then we can learn about other perspectives and also learn about our own. So what does it mean to respond appropriately to epistemic friction? Medina offers two guiding principles to show us what an appropriate response would look like. The first of these is the principle of acknowledgement and engagement. And this says that all perspectives that we encounter must be acknowledged and, where possible, engaged in some manner. And he's quite open about what engagement means here. So he says that that can even include negative engagement. So it's fine to dismiss a view or dismiss another perspective as long as it is first acknowledged and it is genuine engagement. So if you just don't notice that it's there and overlook it, that doesn't count. But you are allowed to dismiss a view. I think that's what he means there. The second of these principles is the principle of equilibrium. And this says that we should strive for an equilibrium between different perspectives, ensuring that none become unchecked and allowed to dominate. So that's what epistemic friction is. Now I'm going to return to talk about Medina's discussion of epistemic character and sketch out where he thinks the potential for epistemic advantage comes from. So as I said, on this view, the epistemic advantage that oppressed people have or can have is grounded in their epistemic character. And this epistemic character is influenced by their experiences, and that in turn influences the subject's ability to respond to friction. And so I've put a table on the handout which goes into some more detail on this idea. So in the first column, we've got two sets of experiences which Medina says are examples or a characteristic of privilege and oppression, respectively. In the next column, we see the kind of character traits that these experiences are supposed to lead to. And in the final column, we see the effect that these character traits are supposed to have on the subject's ability to respond to friction. So the table on the handout goes into some more detail on this. And so let's begin by looking at the top row of this. So privileged people, according to Medina, are at least sometimes educated to be epistemically dominant. So they're taught to see themselves as authoritative and to see other people, and particularly people from marginalized groups, as less credible and less worthy of respect or even of note. And the kind of examples he gives, he's referring to accounts of education during times of slavery in the American South. So the examples he's thinking of here are quite blatant instances of oppression, but he thinks that these generalize to other systems of oppression which are less blatant. And so Medina says that these kinds of experiences lead to traits like epistemic arrogance and closed-mindedness, and they make it difficult for the subjects in question to respond to epistemic friction. So first, privileged subjects are less likely to notice or to engage with friction because they rarely need to do so. And in fact, it might be that they're kind of educated not to do that specifically because that's what helps to keep them in power. If you notice the perspectives of marginalized people, that puts pressure on you to listen to them and change how you behave. And then secondly, even if privileged people do notice and attempt to engage with those other perspectives, they're likely to struggle to do so because they haven't had the practice of having to balance different perspectives and different sources of friction. Oppressed people, on the other hand, moving to the next row, oppressed people are educated to, Medina claims, are educated to be deferential and to acknowledge and assign importance to the views of others, and in particular to the dominant group whose approval their survival often depends on. Medina says that this leads them to develop traits like epistemic humility and open-mindedness, which give them an advantage when it comes to epistemic friction. So they've already developed the kind of character which can notice and engage with multiple sources of friction, and they're well balanced at keeping these sources in, they're well practiced at keeping these sources in balance. So that's an overview of how Medina sees this component of standpoint theory, how he sees epistemic advantage. And there are plenty of criticisms that we might want to make of this view. So, for example, we could question whether oppressed groups and dominant groups really have, even in general, the experiences that Medina attributes to them. We might also question whether these experiences always or often result in the virtues and vices that he says that they do. But I'm going to leave all of that to one side. I'm not too interested in the plausibility of his view today. What I want to focus on is whether this understanding of epistemic advantage, if it was plausible, would block symmetry and therefore relativism. So moving on to the section advantage and symmetry. As I said above, Standpoint theorists traditionally claim that their commitment to the epistemic advantage thesis shows that their views are not relativistic. So does this claim hold up when it comes to Medina's account of epistemic advantage? I don't think that it does. So at first blush, exactly the opposite seems to be true. So on Medina's view, part of achieving epistemic advantage means mastering this principle of equilibrium, which tells us to strive to balance the influence of different systems or perspectives. So this sounds a lot like the idea that systems shouldn't be ranked, and so it sounds more like an endorsement of symmetry than a contradiction of it. And Medina is aware that the principle of equilibrium sounds relativistic, and he tries to deny that it is. So the quote from where he does this is on your handout. He says, "The principle of epistemic equilibrium was not a relativistic principle that demanded giving equal weight to all perspectives. Rather, it was the desideratum of searching for equilibrium on the interplay of cognitive forces, so of friction and different perspectives, without some forces overpowering others and some cognitive influences becoming unchecked and unbalanced." So what's going on here? I think that what Medina is doing here is he's attempting to respond to this claim that there's symmetry in his view, but I think that he only deals with one version of symmetry. So I think he does a good job of showing that the principle of equilibrium is incompatible with equality. It shows that some systems can be better than others and can be given more weight. So that leaves room for the possibility that some are more correct than others. So perhaps his view doesn't involve equality. But this response doesn't tell us anything about symmetry based on non-neutrality, which still seems to be compatible with Medina's account of epistemic advantage. So achieving this equilibrium that Medina advocates requires a standpoint. And in particular, it requires a standpoint. So it requires a particular socially located epistemic perspective or system. And that's exactly what non-neutrality would predict. So whilst Medina has successfully shown that this view isn't compatible with relativism based on equality, he's done nothing to show that his view is incompatible with relativism based on non-neutrality. So much for Medina's account and relativism. What does this tell us about standpoint theory in general? Well, Medina's account makes, I think, the standpoint theorist commitment to non-neutrality particularly clear, because normally epistemic advantage is supposed to kind of de-emphasize this balancing thing and supposed to emphasize the idea that there's a difference going on here, that there's an advantage. And Medina's view is unusual, and it tries to cash that advantage out in a way that emphasizes balance and symmetry. But I don't think that this commitment to symmetry, to non-neutral symmetry, is unique to Medina, and it's not even the epistemic advantage thesis that issues this in. The commitment to non-neutral symmetry is tied up with the standpoint thesis. So to see this, let's look again at the reason that Medina couldn't fully separate his epistemic advantage from symmetry. The problem was that achieving equilibrium, and therefore epistemic advantage, required a standpoint, so a non-neutral, socially located perspective. And this dependence on standpoints for justification isn't a quirk of Medina's view or of epistemic advantage. It follows from the standpoint thesis, because the standpoint thesis says that justification depends on socially located perspectives, and therefore so does justification, which is specifically about ranking perspectives. So this commitment is going to be in any view that involves the standpoint thesis, regardless of the account of epistemic advantage that is then added onto that. So if what I've said is right, then the lesson that we need to take for standpoint theory as a whole is that it's committed to non-neutrality, and so to symmetry, and so to relativism. And that this follows from a central part of the view. So this means that standpoint theorists have a decision to make. So either they can accept epistemic relativism, say, yeah, this is a part of our view, we'll embrace this, or they're going to have to radically rethink or even abandon a central part of their view. They're going to have to abandon the standpoint thesis. And that seems like a really bad idea, because what is standpoint theory without the standpoint thesis? So in this final section, I want to show that a radical rethink or an abandonment of standpoint theory, the standpoint thesis, is unnecessary. I think that the main worries that standpoint theorists have about relativism don't apply to versions of relativism which are based on non-neutral symmetry. And so a relativist version of the view is the best way forwards. So there are two main worries that standpoint theorists have with relativism. So the first of these is social values in science. So Sandra Harding develops a version of standpoint theory within the feminist philosophy of science, and her main contribution here was to suggest a new scientific ideal. She called the existing scientific ideal weak objectivism, and following this ideal meant eradicating all social and political values from science. And Harding said that this project fails, both because it's overambitious, because it tries to remove too many values, and incomplete. So it fails to erase all values and instead leaves behind ones which are sexist. As an alternative to this, she proposed strong objectivity, which allows some values in science, but does so consciously and selectively. So the idea is to be aware of which social and political values are present, and to try and be aware of them and their potential effects. So I'm not going to explain her view more fully than that right now. I'm just going to focus on how this connects to what she thinks about relativism. And what Harding thinks is that relativism is connected with weak objectivity, which is something that standpoint theory is supposed to be against. And I have to confess that I find her argument for this really unclear. And whenever I try to clarify it, it ends up seeming, to me at least, to be wholly unconvincing. So what I've done is I've just quoted what she says about this on the handout, because I worry that either I'm being uncharitable or that I've just misunderstood it completely. So it's all on the handout, and I'm going to do my best to explain and criticise her argument. And if you think that I'm wrong on either parts of that, then please let me know, because I'm very insecure about this point. The quote says that to acknowledge that different social groups have different beliefs and practices doesn't commit you to the further epistemological claim that there are therefore no rational or scientific grounds for making judgments between various patterns of belief and their originating social practices. And she says that many thinkers have pointed out that this kind of judgmental relativism is internally related to objectivism. For example, Donna Haraway argues that judgmental relativism is the other side of the God trick, which is required by what she's called weak objectivity. And here's the crucial part. She says, to insist that no judgments at all of cognitive adequacy can legitimately be made amounts to the same thing as to insist that knowledge can be produced only from no place at all, that is, by someone who can be every place at once. So there's kind of a lot to unpack there, but the best that I can make from this argument is as follows. So the weak objectivist wants to eradicate all values from science and strive for a view which is independent of things like social location and perspective. And Harding describes this as the claim that judgments can be made from no place at all. She then equates this idea to the claim that no judgments at all can be made, in the second underlined part of the quote, or that no comparative judgments can be made about beliefs and their origins, in the first underlined part of the quote. But this isn't part of the relativist view, or at least not relativism involving non-neutrality. So the closest the relativist gets to something like this is the non-neutrality claim, which would say that no neutral judgments can be made. And that's something that Harding agrees with. That's part of what motivated strong objectivity. The idea that we can't make neutral, value-free judgments, whether they're about ranking systems or about anything else, but we can make judgments from a value-laden perspective. So non-neutral relativism doesn't present a problem for strong objectivity. I think actually these two views are, if not equivalent, they're very much in agreement with each other. And so there's no worry about the social values in science for standpoint theorists, even on a relativist view. So then the next set of worries that I think the standpoint theorist has with relativism is that relativism has negative connotations. And I think that this is the real motivator behind resistance to relativism. So again, I'm looking to Harding here, who has identified a number of negative connotations which she thinks should be particularly off-putting for standpoint theorists. The first two are that relativism is seen as the weak term in the objectivist-relativist pair, and that it's coded as feminine. So I take it that her point here is a strategic one. So it's not so much that having these negative connotations suggests that the view is false or more likely to be false, but it does mean that the view is more likely to be or less likely to be taken seriously by scholars, less likely to be given a fair hearing. And if that's the point she's making, then I can see where she's coming from. But I don't think that these connotations should trouble us too much. I don't think that it should worry us when we're thinking about whether relativism is a good way to go for standpoint theory. So for one thing, it's not like feminist standpoint theory doesn't have connotations of being feminine. It's got the word feminist in the title, so I think it has those problems already. And secondly, maybe I'm being naive here, but I think that these connotations are less negative nowadays anyway. So I'm not too worried about those kinds of connotations. But the third connotation, I do think, presents a substantive challenge to what I'm saying. So the epistemic advantage thesis is intended to show the importance and validity of marginalized standpoints, and to enable claims about oppression to be taken more seriously. And according to Harding, relativism is often used to do precisely the opposite. It's been used by dominant groups to undermine the claims of the oppressed, by saying that they're merely relatively justified. So if you're a member of the dominant group and people start coming to you saying we're being oppressed, it's easier to handle that if you can say, well, what you're saying is relative. It's relatively justified. So that's the kind of idea she's got in mind there. And I think that this worry does leave us with some important questions to answer. So first, how can a relativist understanding of epistemic advantage avoid reinforcing oppression? And second, how can it support the aim of tackling oppression? I think the key to answering the first question lies in recognizing that the relativity of a claim alone shouldn't be seen to diminish its credibility or its validity. If you have an absolute view of justification, then mere relativized claims in comparison are going to seem to be inferior. But this isn't the view that relativists have. They don't think that there's some kind of absolute justification to start with. So saying that claims of oppressed people are relatively justified doesn't have to be an objection, because it also applies to the claims of the dominant people as well. So if I'm right and this relativist view follows from the standpoint thesis, then standpoint theorists don't need to worry about reinforcing oppression either, because what I've just said about relativism also applies to relativist standpoint theory. So what about the second question? How can a relativized epistemic advantage support the claims of tackling oppression? Well, even a relativized epistemic advantage thesis can say that some perspectives lead to better or to more accurate claims than others. So that might be based on a story about virtues and vices, like Medina tells, or it could be based on some other account. But that claim, it's still possible to make that claim on the view that I'm suggesting. But of course, this claim does have to be relativized to a non-neutral perspective. It's not going to be an absolute epistemic advantage. But my point here is that this is all that someone who truly understands and endorses the standpoint thesis should want to say. If you claim that you endorse the standpoint thesis and yet you still want to have an absolute advantage which isn't tied to a standpoint, I don't know, I'm just very confused by that. I think if you're a standpoint theorist, then this is all that you should want from the epistemic advantage thesis. Okay, so to sum up then, today I have explored the connection between feminist standpoint theory and relativism. I've demonstrated that the current debate focuses on the epistemic advantage thesis and symmetry based on equality, and that this is missing its target. So I've suggested that instead we shift our attention to the standpoint thesis and to symmetry which is based on non-neutrality. I've argued that when we do this, we quickly see that standpoint theory is committed to relativism at its very core, And so standpoint theorists have to make a decision between embracing relativism or radically rethinking their view. And then finally, I've suggested that embracing relativism is the right way for them to go. Yeah, that's me done. Thanks.